Hello and welcome to Talk From Superheroes. Hey everybody, I'm Andrew Iveme.
And I'm Diana McCullum.
And you're listening to Talk From Superheroes, where every week we discuss a piece of superhero television or film. And this week on the podcast, we are talking about the OG, the original, the 1984, the 1984 Ghostbusters.
They're bustin'.
Bustin' makes them feel good.
Bustin'? Hear me out.
Yeah.
It makes them feel good. Feel good. That's all we can play legally.
Legally, that's all we can do.
That's all we can let you know has happened. I didn't know Andrew had synced that up.
I had that
that's
all
fun
ready
for
to go.
Me.
Bustin'.
That's the Mortal Kombat button.
That's it. That. That's how we're feeling this week. We've been saying how Bustin' makes us feel good. We've been obsessed with it. It started with, so like earlier this week, we're talking about the song, as you do.
When you're going to watch Ghostbusters, you can't not sing the Ghostbusters song. Your body must do it.
You're guns to talk about Ray Parker Jr. So we're talking about the Ghostbusters theme, and Diana made the observation. She was like, "Bustin' makes you feel good means something different now." Has anyone joked about that? And I'm like, "Yes, many people have for sure." But then we found just like the more joyous approach to it, which is forget the sexual connotations,
forget the word bustin',
forget bustin', forget that bustin' means could mean something different now. Forget that. The fact that it's just a celebration of, like, it makes them feel good.
They do this job because they love it.
They love their job.
This is the, like, superhero version of my favorite things. The frickin' old school Julie Andrews song. Like, this is what makes you feel good, Ghostbusters. And they're like, bustin'
my
makes
job.
Me feel good.
My job and makes me feel good.
I think we need more songs in franchises that are just nice. Like, Avengin' makes me feel good.
I want
them to like their job.
I want that joy for more people in life. Like, I want people who are accountants to just be like, taxes make me feel good. Just feel it.
Like, Lewis in this movie would sing that about taxes.
Ooh, he would too.
Taxes make him feel good.
Taxes make him feel good.
Accountant makes Lewis feel good.
He's feeling good.
That's what's nice about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if Bustin' didn't have a secondary meaning, then it just is Ghost Bustin' makes me feel good. And that's what it is. And that is just nice.
Yeah.
I like that they like their jobs.
I like that it just makes them feel good.
Like, at the end of this movie, Ernie Hudson's like, I love this job. And I'm like, it makes him feel good.
Yeah. Like, all the synonyms of this sentence with its intended meaning are such simple joys. Just accomplishing my job brings me joy. Any synonym of this sentence is the simplest, purest celebration of life.
And it really makes you want to call them.
Uh-huh.
Because they love their jobs.
They love their... Oh, if there was an ad of someone who's like, plumbing makes me feel good, I'd be like, that is the person I am a-ringing when I need a plumber.
You know why else I call that plumber?
Uh-huh, tell me more.
His rates are probably going to be so reasonable. Mm. He loves his job.
He's doing it for just the love of the game.
He still deserves adequate pay.
Absolutely.
But he will not
even
be
when you love what you do, you deserve a good wage.
He will not be overcharging me.
No.
He will be charging me fair tender.
Yeah. And I'll happily overpay him because I will get something out of seeing him leave my now unclogged home or whatever is going on and seeing the joy on his face.
Because plumbing made him feel good.
Because plumbing makes him feel good.
Oh, plumbers can be ladies, by the way.
Yeah.
Anyone can be a plumber.
It makes him or her feel good.
It makes them feel good.
It makes them feel good.
All the plumbers in the world. All the Ghostbusters out there.
Makes me feel good. That's nice.
It's a really nice energy to start your movie off with and to play through the whole movie.
It's as simple as that. I will restrain myself as much as I can for the episode.
So we're going to talk about Ghostbusters.
We're
going
to be talking
today.
About Ghostbusters. We are building up to the release of Ghostbusters Afterlife.
That is the name.
Which is
colon.
The name, colon, Afterlife. I didn't realize until like a week ago it had a subtitle. I thought it was just Ghostbusters.
Oh, I knew it did because the one with the ladies had a subtitle too, like... OG Ghostbusters are Ghostbusters.
No.
Did the ladies not have a subtitle?
No, the ladies...
Oh, they added it later.
They added it later.
Yes.
It's not part of the title of the movie, but it's just like, we don't know what that extra sentence is doing there on all the posters and marketing materials. So it's like all of the shit has an extra sentence on there that legally the film is not called. The film is just called Ghostbusters.
I do recall that now. It's kind of like, it's like sneakier than this, but it's like how Avengers is called Avengers Assemble in the UK because Avengers is already like a superhero team there.
Not dissimilar.
But like, yeah, but technically that movie's not called Avengers Assemble, but that's what the posters say. Yeah. But yeah, the Lady Ghostbusters was it did have like a secondary thing, but
the studios are just like, oops, we don't know what that sentence
not in
is
any
doing
of the
there.
Filing of the papers.
No.
Just on the posters.
In none of the paperwork or any of the legal things did it have anything like that.
No one's contract that they signed said Ghostbusters, whatever that line is. We're looking it up now because we can't look it up easily.
Answer the call.
Answer the call because it makes them feel good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or who you gonna call?
Oh, there's two different ones?
There's two different ones. Either way, they tried to make it seem like there was a subtitle.
Anyway, but the next one coming out is Ghostbusters: Afterlife.
Afterlife is what they
officially
got going
on. So we're doing the OG before we do the new.
Because we're building up to that. Ghostbusters Afterlife was pushed back a week. So we'll be doing that in 3 weeks now? 3 weeks now.
They pushed it back a week really quietly. No one ever talks about these 1 and 2 week pushes that just mess our schedule up.
And are just kind of quietly happening. They did what I thought No Time to Die was going to do. Remember how, like, for a month I was like, there's no way No Time to Die is actually. Now, granted, No Time to Die had burned all of the world like 4 different times with moving its date. But I was like, there's no way that's coming out that week. It's going to get pushed back at least a week. Ghostbusters Afterlife did that. So we'll be doing that in 3 weeks. Next week on the podcast, we'll be doing Eternals, then Red Notice, then Ghostbusters. Afterlife.
If you're wondering about our schedule.
But we're doing the OG 1984 one today. So we're going to be getting into that in just a moment. But before we do get into Ghostbusters 1984, we want to thank the wonderful people who are sponsoring this episode today. We want to thank our friends over at Batman The Audio Adventures. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about Batman The Audio Adventures. Bruce Wayne may appear to be a wealthy playboy, but beneath this facade, his true identity is that of the Batman, waging an endless war against crime. Join the Caped Crusader in Batman The Audio Adventures, the first scripted audio original featuring Batman and his villainous rogues gallery in a world premiere story of life and death in Gotham City, debuting exclusively on HBO Max.
Starring Jeffrey Wright as Batman and a who's who of incredible Saturday Night Live alums, this rollicking adventure told across 10 episodes is written and directed by Emmy winner Dennis McNicholas, includes devilishly delightful original music by Doug Bossi, and performances by Rosario Dawson, John Leguizamo, Chris Parnell, Melissa Villaseñor, Seth Meyers, Jason Sudeikis, Brooke Shields, Fred Armisen, and many, many more. Go to hbomax.com/Batman Audio Adventures for more and stream Batman The Audio Adventures only on HBO Max.
And thank you to Batman The Audio Adventures for in part sponsoring this episode. And now let's get into it. Let's talk about 1984's Ghostbusters.
It makes me feel good.
Right, we are ready to talk about 1984's. That's the last one. So, Diana, Ghostbusters, did you like it?
I liked it. I didn't love it. And that kind of surprised me. I haven't watched it in a really long time. And I didn't remember ever, like, loving it. But I assumed I would as an adult. So this has been kind of a weird experience for me. Because I really even hate saying this because it is a good friend of the podcast, Ian McIntyre's absolute favorite movie, but I only just liked it. I kind of think it's like paced a little poorly and doesn't have all that big a laughs. Like there's some big laughs, but then there's like long periods of like no laughs and then just some Bill Murray being like really inappropriate. So yeah, it's like, it's fun and it's like, it's entertaining to watch. There's a lot of surprises. It's just a like for me. Andrew, how do you feel about Ghostbusters?
I really liked it. I'm a borderline love for this. I think it's great. I agree with you. There are some highly problematic things.
It's an 80s comedy all the way through.
Absolutely. There are some horrific moments. Mm-hmm. Comedy is the thing that ages the least well of all genres. So it ages, comedy ages, whatever the opposite of wine is how comedy ages. So there is that. But I think I love it just because I'm like, this is the best of Bill Murray to me. And that is aside from like the problematic writing and moments of his character, where like there is no other actor who, even in retrospect, like it opens with some problematic shit for Venkman. No other actor would be able to recover out of that hole in retrospect.
To make the character likable.
Other than Bill Murray doing just everything possible with this character. And Rick Moranis being wonderful. This movie is held on the strength of the performances. And there is a lot of fun stuff. There's some writing that doesn't hold up that turns out to be problematic. And there's some writing that like maybe isn't modern pacing. But I think like the performances are what really put this entire thing on its back and make it a treat for me to watch even today.
That's totally fair. And I don't think the movie's bad by any means. I do get why people love this movie. I can see the love in this. Like if you kind of watch it at a young age and it really like permeates into your soul and you take this as your like roots of comedy. And it is brilliant comedy at times. And you're right, it's the best of Bill Murray, especially because he's surrounded by other comedians who get him.
And
are just letting him do what he does, which is ad-lib most of his lines, I'm assuming. and people have said he's ad-libbed most of his lines. And they're wonderful. And you're right. Him and, like, Alan Alda in MASH are the only two that can get away with these two sexual characters who don't respect boundaries and you still like them.
Right.
There is definitely a lot to love in Ghostbusters. It's only a like for me, but I get love in Ghostbusters. It picks up as it goes. Like once that Marshmallow Man shows up, I'm like, I'm all in. He's so cute. He's so
great,
adorable.
A great character design. I mean, I think pretty much just a stolen Michelin Man, but still, like it works really well for this.
Yeah. What are things that you love then?
It's just largely performance. I think part of the reason why Bill works so well in this movie and kind of puts the whole thing on its back. I mean, part of it is the fact that Dan and Harold wrote this movie, and I believe like uncredited, the director Ivan Reitman also wrote a considerable amount as well. But when people are playing multiple roles on a film, when it's like a star writer or an actor director, director writer. I feel like there is a certain level of like of distraction, even if it's not intended or even if it's not palpable. And just Bill Murray being the guy who's like, didn't write it, not directing it, I'm showing up, I'm going wild, I'm doing everything. Just someone who's being 100% dedicated to his character and being in the moment. And it's really, it adds just a certain presence and charm throughout this whole movie that I really adore.
Oh, I think it really works as a great point about how he's not distracted by anything else. He's like, I'm here to be funny and sarcastic and very aloof and have this very odd brand of comedy that no one else does. That is very much him. I would say, though, gun to my head, I think Rick Moranis is funnier than him in this movie.
I mean, you might be right.
He doesn't have as much screen time.
Yeah.
But minute per minute availability of laughs and hilariousness, I think Rick Moranis crushes it. So good. Just like little things like getting locked out of his thing over and over again. That like the way he's like annoying but also totally sweet.
Pure and innocent, but a little too much, but still very well liked. Like he is several people we know where it's like you're a bit too much. You're incredibly nerdy and you love your job and you do talk a mile a minute. But there is something about someone who never stops talking and likes what they do that is attractive to have people around. Like, that does usually, like, draw people into your life.
But, like, and also just, like, the most brilliant writing for him, I think, is when Sigourney Weaver is like, I have a date. And he's just like, well, you can bring him. And he's like, he's not defensive. He's just like, of course she has a date. Like, but he still wants her to come. And my biggest joy in this movie, the thing that makes me feel good, is that so many people came to his party.
He's a great accountant. Everyone loves hanging out with him.
He must be phenomenal at his job. But everyone who showed up, and he like, I love a host that introduces everyone to the whole party. That's so killer to walk in and be like, this is Bob and Margaret and they own a house downtown. Who wants to talk to Bob and Margaret? I'm like, you're such a good host.
Yeah.
Rick Moranis.
such a good host. He's got like lovely food. He's talking too much about how much money he saved on getting it, but he's got lovely food. Everyone's taken care of. He's checking in on everyone. He also has a woman interested in him who is not only interested in him, but whose interest is waning because, not because he's focused on Dana down the hall, he just popped in for a second, but because he's too focused on his hosting duties. The three dimensions they have added to his character are a delight. It adds so much.
When he says we should dance to try to get her back into it, and she's fully on board, I'm like, oh, you're actually here on a date. You're not a person that he hired or tricked into coming here. Like, this is an actual date. I actually really like that he talks about how much money he saved for this particular reason. He's not showing that he's cheap. He's showing that he's good at saving you money, and they're all clients of his.
Oh, jeez. I hadn't even thought of it like that.
That's why.
A bad perspective.
You want a guy who's going to find a good deal on every angle to do your taxes.
Huh.
That's why he's talking about money so much.
Interesting.
Because he doesn't really talk about money with Dana. With Dana, he's like, I have a lot of vitamins and I have mineral water. But he doesn't say what they cost or anything.
Right.
He does that with his clients.
He's trying to show off a little bit in front of everyone, but he's also trying to show off in different ways.
And this is going to sound crazy again. I think he might be the most fleshed out character in this movie.
I think to a certain degree.
We know about his personal life away from all the busting. Like, we know many things about his job, all these people who he hangs out with, what he does with Dana. He works out. He's busy. Like,
yeah.
Only you're like halfway through the movie before you find out Dana's a cellist.
Yeah.
Don't know anything about her internal life, what she's doing other than being possessed by Zool.
Right, right. We get we see her with an instrument when she's first introduced. But to know that she's a cellist in an orchestra, it does take a little bit.
So yeah, Rick Moranis is the highlight of this film for me.
But still, even with Dana, the fact that she is a cellist in an orchestra, and that's not a major plot point. It's not like the orchestra is not being taken over. It's not like the conductor of the Philharmonic is the evil demon. That is just a fleshed out aspect of her character that is not necessarily plot relevant, but it adds a richness to the world and interactions they have. Even the fact that when Venkman like shows up to flirt with her, she is like leaving the orchestra with another gentleman who presumably plays in the orchestra as well. I think she mentions one instrument, but it's irrelevant. But they're kind of flirting, maybe not. But they're not dating. Like, he's not her boyfriend. It's not this awkward, like, we're introducing her boyfriend. We're just introducing a rich social life that she has, leaving work, but talking with a work friend slash colleague who could be a love interest. Like, just, like, a lot of little details that are completely unnecessary without being distracting, which is a very hard line to toe.
Ooh, in a movie like this where you're looking for clues and stuff all the time.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
You're right. They aren't... Because as they're leaving, you would expect, because Dana has so little screen time where she's talking, a lot of her screen time is being possessed by Zool and watching the TV that they're on it. That's most of Dana's screen time. But some of the screen time they gave her was her coming out of work and saying, what a bad conductor we had this week, who's the guest conductor, and not just being like, my apartment's being weird, or like, she's talking, her life has gone on.
Yeah.
Past the possession of the apartment.
Yeah, she had a weird day, and she's like, I'm just moving on past that. I'm not bringing it up to my coworkers.
And then I met a weird dude, but I live in New York, so what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised this movie isn't more focused on the fact that New Yorkers would try to fight the ghosts themselves.
Okay.
Like, it doesn't feel like it's set in New York, because no one's like, ghosts, I don't care. Fight them. Get off my lawn.
I mean, a little bit Dan Aykroyd's character, Ray, at one point his response is, let's get her. And that's his only plan. So Ray might be the true New Yorker of the bunch.
Yeah, he might be the most New York.
Yeah.
He does his best.
Now, there is, I think, one, talking about how, like, Dana and Rick Moranis' character,
Lewis,
yeah. Dana and Lewis are these, like, rich three-dimensional characters, possibly even more so than the Ghostbusters. I do like that the Ghostbusters, it's maybe not as solid as what these side characters are, but I think I kind of like the balance there, where it's like you get more screen time, and maybe we don't need to know kind of as much about your personal life because we're going to get to know you through conversation a bit more. I think there actually might be a smart balance at play there and not so much a mistake to be like, why do the side characters have more dimension in their life than the main characters? And it's like, well, because we're going to spend a lot of time with the main characters, and we need to get the impression that side characters have had time before we show up. I kind of like the balance it strikes.
I don't mind the balance. I actually wouldn't mind a little bit more time with the main characters, or at least more given to them. I would say specifically Ernie Hudson and Dan Aykroyd, who it's surprising I didn't write himself anything to do in this movie. His character has no storyline. Like, Ernie Hudson arrives late, so it kind of explains why there's no storyline for him. Bill Murray's into Dana, and that's his whole thing. And then Harold Ramis?
Yes.
Harold Ramis and the secretary kind of have a thing going on, and that's like not right. a story, not an arc, but a storyline for him. Dan Aykroyd got nothing.
Hey.
He's not.
Hey.
Oh, I know what you're saying.
Hey. Dan Aykroyd gets a dream blowjob from a ghost. All
That's
right.
literally the only singular thing this character does in this film.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have anyone he talks to that isn't the Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. He doesn't talk to the EPA guy.
Yeah.
He is with them the whole time and has nothing to do except get head from a ghost in a dream. It's not even real. It's there's.
He's dreaming about getting a blowjob from a ghost where he goes, oh, blowjob's so good he goes cross-eyed.
Yeah, the choices of this.
So I don't know how you could say he's not a fleshed out character.
He's fleshed out something.
Think about this. You are at a party. Mm-hmm. You are at an event. You don't know these people. And it's like, let's go around the table and get to know a little something about everyone.
About the characters?
About the people who are at this dinner party you're at. It goes to the first person. The first person's like, I'm a psychologist. I used to work at the university. Now I bust ghost. Busting makes me feel good.
Excellent. Love that. Love that you love your job.
You go to the next person and she's like, hey, I play cello. I'm second seat in an orchestra. The conductor we had this week is a little bit weird. You go to the next guy, he's like, I'm an accountant. I'm great at taxes. I'm having a party. You go to the next guy and like the next guy is like, I had a dream last night that I got blown by a ghost. You've heard everything you need to know about that man. You do not stay at the table and be like, but what do you do for a living? You have now heard the maximum amount that you would like to know about that human being in any social circumstance. No one's doubling back to that guy.
So Dan Aykroyd decided, instead of an arc, I'm going to have a weird dream.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying, but here's my counterpoint.
I wouldn't talk
to that guy any further. I'd be like, you have a good night, sir, and I would definitely walk away.
Naturally.
But Dan Aykroyd, at no point in this movie, offers that information to anyone. That's his own private business.
Right,
At no point does he go up to Bill Murray and he's like, did you guys have a dream about ghost head sex? But it's like medieval for some reason and I'm a count maybe.
He was wearing a very fanciful outfit.
He had made himself a character.
Right, that is true.
He was cosplaying in some way.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you considered this?
I probably haven't. That's the actual busting.
That's
though.
The busting. Now, in that scenario, I do mean the sexual connotation of the busting.
He literally busting the ghost.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Busting these nuts.
You busting the ghost, it busts faster?
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows how it all works?
Who knows about the ectoplasmic properties of busting in the ghost?
So that scene was in there.
So that scene was in there, and it's literally the only character development of Dan Aykroyd's character. Mm. Could have done without it.
While we're on a harping kind of vibe, while we're harping on this, let's talk about the first scene where we meet Venkman, Bill Murray's character, Peter Venkman, and he is inappropriately manipulating, hitting on, and trying to sleep with students.
He is doing several things in this scene. He is manipulating Data. For his experiments.
Sure. Bad scientist.
He's bad at science.
Yeah.
He is electrocuting students. Bad teacher / human. And he is trying to date a female student. He is trying to take her out for dinner. He is a professor at this university.
Uh-huh.
She is a titular student. And he is like, I gotta get this girl out on a date. Gotsta. Gotta keep telling her she's psychic and manipulating her and definitely grooming this young lady.
And this is a fun, air quote, fun way to introduce this character.
Yeah, this is our main character, and he electrocutes boys and he hits on young girls.
Yes. Yeah.
And gonna be hard to like this dude.
I fully agree. It's wild that Bill Murray does such a fun job in this role that this becomes likable in any regard, because this is just a heinous way to introduce the character.
Especially because it's almost back-to-back with the scene with Sigourney Weaver in her apartment where he is intolerable.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, she literally pushes him out of the apartment, and not in a way where you're like, after she closed the door, I bet she was like, oh, wait a minute, he was cute. Like, she sincerely needed him to leave.
Yeah.
He was overstaying his welcome and inappropriately forward about it.
And what's wild, though, is how much I sincerely buy from both of their performances the switch that clicks in when he shows up outside of her work, like at the fountain, that scene at the fountain, where I'm like, she is coming around to him and his shit is working. And they both sell it in that scene. But it is wild that they give a good enough performance to hit that switch so hard when up until then I'm like, you two are just hideous together. This shouldn't work.
Yeah, Bill Murray really got, like, wingmanned by the press.
A little bit?
Because she didn't care for him at all. But then she's like, well, Casey Kasem talked about him on the radio in that Casey Kasem voice that I love.
Who
and
doesn't?
And that seemed to be all she needed.
Yeah.
Because he'd done nothing else towards her to make himself likable.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, you're right. Performance-wise, they had the chemistry, and, like, I believed it. But in my heart, I'm like, no, Sigourney Weaver.
No, please don't.
Don't. You're better than this. Mm-hmm. This guy sucks. He turned out to not suck, because I will say this movie has a wonderful redemption of I'm not going to sleep with a possessed woman.
Yes.
Wonderfully redemptive of Bill Murray's character.
Yep.
He is far too forward, but has a line. Oddly enough.
I'm just now realizing that this is more progressive than Wonder Woman 1984. Oh my God, in literally the year 1984, they did the progressive version of this, which is you are someone else inhabiting a body that has not consented to you inhabiting it. That is not consensual sex, and I will not participate in it.
I am picturing Diana of Themyscira going to the movies after Chris Pine's character has vanished away into the air and watching Ghostbusters 1 in the year 1984.
Spoilers for Wonder Woman 84, I guess, but it's been long enough.
She goes to the movies, watches Ghostbusters, and says, oh no, you're not supposed to sleep with bodies that don't consent.
It's not cool.
Shit, Bill Murray's character is better than me.
How much this is synchronizing and the fact that it's the same year is kind of tripping me out right now. This is all coming and clicking in at the moment.
Really weird. Yeah, like Ghostbusters was the first people to say you shouldn't.
Yeah.
They drew that line. Don't have sex with possessed people, guys.
No.
It's
That's
wrong.
A good line.
I'm for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad Ghostbusters threw that out into the world.
Yeah,
you shouldn't do it.
So he has a very reasonable line there. So that's good. They do make him not a lunatic. They have that he has some boundary. Whether or not that boundary is still took too long to get there, but he has a boundary, and that is an important thing to establish for his character, and it helps you kind of wean it back a little bit across the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, since we're... Oh, may I?
Last thing I want to circle back to. That opening psychological experiment.
Oh, right. I'm so sorry.
I agree. Inappropriate. Mm-hmm. Sexually inappropriate, professionally inappropriate, in several ways inappropriate. If he wasn't trying to ask her out, though, I actually think it might have been part of the experiment, because the guy that he's constantly punishing... and then the female student, he's constantly rewarding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it ends with him asking out the female student and flirting with her, which is completely inappropriate. But he's punishing the male student, and then he starts getting the cards right. And he's positively reinforcing the female student, and she has no motivation and does not get the cards right. And when the male student asks him about this, is like, what's going on? He's like, we're testing how positive and negative reinforcement will affect ESP. And if that is, in fact, the condition of the test, it is proving that fear is a better motivator for ESP than reward. And this is an actual controlled experiment. So there is something about it that's actually kind of like off-putting. And it's almost consistent for his character, who throughout the movie is, I would say, like, sincerely insincere. Like, he is always kind of like telling the truth, but with a tone of sarcasm. but with ulterior motives, but he's never outright lying. There's something very strange about him that he's hard to read. I think that constantly negatively reinforcing and electroshocking one student and telling the other one that they're right might have been the intention of the experiment.
Fuck, you know what? I'm going to completely agree with this. Because, like, as much as he's inappropriate at times and weird, he is a scientist.
Yeah.
And he would have set up the experiment. And he's a dick. And he was like, and he would have been like, how can I set up an experiment to be a dick, but still get data?
Yeah.
And I would believe this because he is very hard to read. Because I would say the hardest thing to read about him is he seems like he doesn't believe in ghosts. And as this movie starts, even though he works with two guys in paranormal stuff, yeah. He doesn't seem like he really believes in them. But then when he sees a ghost, he's not like, oh shit, you guys were right. He sees a ghost. He's like, oh yeah, all three of us were correct that ghosts are real. Like, he didn't create the science of it, but he doesn't seem all that shocked that there is ghosts.
Yeah.
Even though he's skeptical earlier and, like, sarcastic and sarcastic and not, like, on board super, he does believe. So, like, isn't lying about believing, and he's not saying it's not real. So, yeah, the test could accurately be what's happening, because it is weird that he guesses that shape, because wavy lines is a very uncommon shape.
And the guy even says three wavy lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the most complex card that has been there so far, and the guy nails it after receiving multiple negative So I think that might be the intention of the experiment, followed immediately by being professionally and personally inappropriate, mm-hmm. but it might have been the intention of the experiment.
Might have been the intention.
All right, well, let's take a quick break in the podcast to thank another wonderful sponsor of today's episode. We want to thank our good friends over at Virtual Game Night.
Over at Virtual Game Night, where you're going to have an amazing time with your family or coworkers having a virtual game night. Hopefully, we'll get to all of our holiday gatherings in person this year, but if you can't, let's do it virtual one last time. It's your last chance, guys.
Yes, it's your last chance. Virtual Game Night is taking bookings through December 23rd, 2021 only. We've done this several times at the network. We recommend it to everyone, both on the podcast and off air, to just friends, acquaintances, coworkers. We think this is sincerely a delight of a time, and everybody should be doing this because it works in every given setting. If you have a big corporate or business event, this is a great holiday get-together. If you have like a small family thing, if you have just like a fun way to like spruce up a hangout with friends, this is a great way, because what it is it is what it sounds like. It's a virtual game night, but it's so amped up and so much more than that while still being easy for you to do. It is going to give you, first of all, TV production level quality. It is going to feel like a TV show, somewhere in between a TV show and a pub trivia night that you and friends would go to. You're competing against one another, but you're all doing it right through Zoom and through your phone or a second tab in your web browser where you answer questions. All of the scores and everything is tallied up live. So you're competing while you're talking and looking at one another, like you're still all connected. You have a live host, comedian Ollie, who's guiding you through everything. So it's just taken care of for you. It's a beautiful time.
It's so much fun. These were the highlights of deep quarantine when we could not leave the house at all. Like, we looked so forward to every time we had a virtual game night. We had three of them on the network. They're an incredible time. Having Ollie there just takes all of the work away from you, because someone's always in charge of organizing the holiday party, and it's stressful. And like,
even when it's not a holiday party, someone's always the Zoom call captain.
Yeah,
it's not always discussed. It's not always admitted.
But we
all know that there's always a Zoom call captain, and it may not even be the person who sent out the link and hosted the call. But there's always a call captain, and we know it.
There is, and it's very kind of them to take over the call. But
we appreciate
Ollie,
we salute you, call captains.
Ollie is a professional. He will handle everything. He's so funny, and he's so easy to work with. And you can just enjoy your night. Everyone will be so relaxed. It will go so smooth. And the games are for everyone. This is not just straightforward trivia. There's a bunch of different games. There's going to be games you're great at. There's going to be games you're okay at. It's not just the same thing through the entire show.
Yeah, it's spelling bees, it's decoding. Yes, you can have traditional quizzing, but you can also have like sequencing game, world records. You can have ones where you've got to do a pitch around as well. So it's so much fun. There's just a bunch of different options. And what you're going to want to do is you can schedule one, and they can last 30, 60, or 90 minutes. They have provided events for some of the best-known companies like Adobe, Ford, Ford, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Bank of America, as well as ones for students and alumni of institutions like MIT, Yale, Harvard, and also just for local dum-dums like the From Superheroes Network as well.
We're so real dumb, you guys.
As big as you need it to be, it can be that. As small as you might want it to be, it can be that as well. It is just going to be a fun, incredible time where you get to sit back, relax, and play some trivia with your friends. It's a delight. So turn a virtual gathering into a virtual game night today by visiting virtualgamenight.live/superhero and use code SUPERHERO100 to take $100 off the price of any game. Remember, the games must end December 23rd, 2021, so join over 17,000 other players who have livened up their Zoom calls by making your next, and hopefully last, virtual event a virtual game night at virtualgamenight.live/superhero. And don't forget to enter code SUPERHERO100 to receive a $100 credit toward the price of any game night package. And thank you, Virtual Game Night, for your support and your very fun times.
Thanks, VGN.
And now, back to Ghostbusters.
Now, I have to get into something very funny, but this is kind of how the 80s of it all again, because we've talked about this movie has a dream with a blowjob, inappropriate trying to date a student.
Of course.
Not having sex with someone who says things like, I need you inside me, and very, very sexual things happen. I think there's a few more things. A man is called Dickless. And I cannot emphasize enough that they turned this movie into a children's cartoon.
Yeah.
And that is wild to me. And like children dressed up as Ghostbusters a la Stranger Things. And this movie's only rated PG somehow. I don't know if PG-13 existed yet.
Right, right.
There is just so much that is not PG or G here.
Yeah, yeah. There's like four boys are out there like together as friends. And they're like, I'm the Venkman. I hit on my students. And someone's like, I'm the Ray. Ghosts blow me in my dreams. Like there's a lot of weird problematic stuff. Yeah. Going
they on have
there.
One female friend, and they're like, I'm Dana. Have sex with me right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot to take in. And then they were like, children's cartoon.
Even Egon gets away with being appropriate, but at the same time, it's like, Egon's like, I've been heavily flirting with my secretary. Like, okay, you know, that's still, this seems very consensual, and you two actually do seem like a quiet couple, a good couple. And
they seem really cute together.
And it is possible, but incredibly difficult and legally precarious to date in the workplace, but you should not be flirting with, your employee.
I actually don't think he's flirting at all. I think he is being kind. She's flirting.
Yeah, all right, all
she's
right.
She's hardcore flirting. He is very oblivious, like Sheldon.
Egon, you get a pass.
Egon, you're the only good one amongst us. And Ernie Hudson, because he has no lines and nothing to do.
Yeah, Winston's all right. Winston just wants a job.
I got no problem with Winston. Winston's just working here.
He's working
here.
He's
the most New York. He's just working here. Mm-hmm. He's just trying to work.
All right, that's true. But yeah, it is wild that this is like a PG movie like that kids
became
love.
That became a
Saturday morning
and
cartoon.
Not like a
called
late
the
night.
The real Ghostbusters.
The real? Why did it get called
Well,
that?
This is a fictionalized version of what the... And the real Ghostbusters is a documentary of what the real Ghostbusters have been through.
Here's a secret the real Ghostbusters don't want you to know. It doesn't make them feel good.
Oh, that's fucking nuts.
Yeah.
So they took some liberties with the fictionalization.
The real Ghostbusters are just down in the dirt. And they're like, it needs to be done, but we don't like doing it.
Right. This is just a job for us.
They're Winstons.
Right, right. But for the movie, they Hollywooded it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. They're like, we need to make it look like we're having fun out there.
We got for the kids.
Yeah.
For the adults?
For the adults and
the
kids.
The real Ghostbusters are for the kids.
Or for the kids. Yeah, yeah. The kids want the bleak understanding.
I would actually, you know what? I get that as a kid. I didn't watch this because I was only like 2 when the cartoon came out. But I think I would have loved that as a kid, being like, oh shit, the real Ghostbusters.
The real.
My mom watched the fake Ghostbusters. These are the real ones.
But it was also of the era where, you know, yes, we were children, but it was also of the era where it was like, if something became a Saturday morning cartoon, even if they only made one season of it, it was a Saturday morning cartoon for like a decade. So it's like, I still watched these when I was a kid, even though I should have been, a baby.
I don't really remember watching them. I was going to say they only make it a cartoon for toy purposes.
Ah, I see what you're saying.
Because it's harder
there.
To make, I think, movie things into toys back then. Or Star Wars did it. But, like, cartoons go into toys much easier.
Now, I would disagree there. And I'm sure that there were cartoon tie-in stuff. But everyone that I know was, like, clamoring for movie merchandise. Mm. I didn't know anyone with a single action figure or toy from the cartoon series.
I've seen way more cartoon series stuff. I think it was cheaper and easier to get.
Right. Okay. I mean, that's for sure. Mm. That's for sure.
Because, like, you can tell because everyone have, like, crazy hair colors and stuff in the show ones.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember that, like, at one point I had the catcher, like, the foot pedal one.
Okay.
The one that they roll out that they like catch it
oh,
in.
Oh, okay. Little, the trap.
The trap. Okay. The trap. Gotcha. I forget what the actual title, what it's called, but I had like that official toy as
Ooh,
a kid.
Oh, shit.
And that
That's
was
cool.
That was like the talk of the school. Everyone was like, Andrew's got the trap.
That's fucking dope.
And it was a cool one. Like it had like good like luggage rolly wheels on it, which at the time, those wheels did not, good rolly wheels did not exist.
I don't think even luggage had rolly wheels in the 80s.
No, like luggage had maybe one, like, luggage was a fucking mess in the 80s.
I carried luggage until, like, 2002.
Yeah, they weighed 80 pounds. It was brutal. But it had good rolly wheels. It would roll out, and it had, like, a big tube. And then it actually had, like, a foot pedal at the end of the tube, and you would press it, and it would use air pressure to, like, shoot the little doors open of the trap, and then it would close. So it was no batteries, no anything. It just used air pressure to, like, shoot it open and close. It was cool as hell.
That is cool as hell.
Yeah.
One final note about the 80s of it all.
Yeah, let's get back to it.
So much fucking smoking in this movie.
Was this movie sponsored by cigarettes?
Just general cigarettes? Because there's no brand.
And I know
that's
there was
wild.
I know there was a lot of cigarettes in movies in the 80s and prior. But man, everybody's smoking in this one.
And in a very casual way that is like, there's one scene where it's incorporated. Like, Ray is smoking as he's looking for a ghost, and then it, like, hangs from his lip in a funny way.
And they do the comedic, like, I'm so aghast, my mouth is agape, and then the smoke rolls out.
Yeah, and I'm like, okay, I know why you were smoking in this scene. It was for comedic purposes. But then there's just, like, a scene in the basement at one point where all four Ghostbusters are chatting, and they're all just passing around a single pack. You never see the label, though. And they all just light up.
Yeah.
And it's, in 2021, it's mind-blowing.
Even not in 2021. I'm going to say this.
Do you think this, like, I can't think of an 80s movie where they smoked this much.
It's not coming to me, but I'm going to say a lot of 80s movies they smoked this much. I think Lethal Weapon has a fair amount of...
We've reviewed 80s movies before.
I think, maybe not Riggs and Murtaugh, but I think in Lethal Weapon, literally, like, the police department is almost hard to visually see on the camera because every background cop is chain-smoking. But it's easy to have, like, just general smoking in an 80s movie. You would see a lot of that. What blows me away about this is because I have had acting gigs where I'm smoking on camera. And it's, you know, it's, well, it's not, it wasn't this year, but, you know, it's, it was the 20-teens when I did that. So we're using, like, stage clove cigarettes, which are safe. I'm sure they were using real cigarettes on the set of this movie.
Yeah, it was the 80s. They didn't care.
And it is... it is a nightmare in order to get consistency for the take,
for
and
the
especially
length of the cigarette.
If you have Bill Murray improvising. So if you've got a 4-minute scene of all of them at the firehouse, and they all light a cigarette at the beginning of the scene, and Bill Murray goes off and does some fucking improv, and they're trying to splice takes together. Every take, you've got to light up a new smoke. Like, the amount of smoking you have to do just to get consistency, like to get continuity, sorry, is the word that was escaping me. The continuity alone involved so many smokes, I'm sure, in order to get one scene where they're all smoking. It is an insane amount of smoking to the point where it's like, I've smoked in my life, and even the clove cigarettes, trying to film a scene smoking clove cigarettes, I was like, I'm going to die. Like, these fake stage cigarettes are absolutely murdering me right now.
And to think of doing that in half your scenes, not just one scene where you were like, the cigarette people paid us, so we have a scene where all the Ghostbusters smoke.
Yeah.
But to be like in multiple scenes, in the car when they're driving, they're smoking, at the office, they're smoking, while they're busting, they're smoking. Smoking makes them feel good.
So while they're busting, yeah, they're smoking all the time.
It's wild.
A lot of
Sigourney Weaver doesn't smoke. I like that.
Oh, yeah, that is true.
It feels like true to her as a person and a character.
Neither does Rick Moranis's. Moranis'
character. No, his body couldn't handle. He's too in shape. He works out.
Oh, he's working out all the time.
He's taking vitamins and vitamin water.
That's true.
He's too healthy to smoke.
That is true. He's a healthy man.
That man's going to live forever. I know why the gatekeeper chose him. He was the most in-fit man in the building.
I like that the gatekeeper and the keymaster, the gatekeeper and keymaster, the two gargoyles who come to life and then inhabit a human body, choose neighbors and then also get separated. It is such shit luck. They're so terrible at this. They were literally 10 feet away from one another, by default.
But Rick Moranis ran away.
Why, though, then that character, the keymaster, could not remember where it was from or ran from?
Yeah,
just chosen someone else at the party?
I mean, I think I would assume because they lived in the building that was like pulling in demonic energy, they'd both been filled with it by living there.
Right.
But there is I get why he had to be the host, but there is no reason why he couldn't find his house after he was possessed. He didn't run that far.
Right.
I know, like, it's a grid system. Demon. Okay, you live in New York. It's up and down. It's left and right. There's nothing too complicated about getting to where you're going to go. So yeah, they didn't do a good job, the gatekeeper demons. And also, it's weird that they were like, we have to take over two humans, and then they let Zool in, and then we turn into gargoyles again.
They do turn back into gargoyles.
Why do we have to become
humans? But gargoyles
humans?
that have Dana and Lewis inside of them somehow. So yeah, they're making some wild choices, those gargoyles.
They are. I guess I can kind of understand it though when I think about it. Like, if you're a gatekeeper between two worlds, your gatekeeper has to be of both worlds.
Okay, so it's like they're switching form, and as the worlds are coming together, they can choose, and then they switch back, maybe?
I don't know.
We don't need the full lore. I'm fine with it.
There's very little lore in this movie.
There's only a handful. I kind of like how much they give, though. It's the right amount. Like, the police station scene, where they kind of lay out, like, this building was owned by a crazy person who had a cult, and they set it up to bring the devil back. Or to bring back, you know, Zool, a version of a Mesopotamian devil or whatever it was. I kind of like that they're just like, that's all you need to know. Crazy architect, some wild shit, devil coming.
I actually do really like it. It's wild because it's so confident. Any other movie, literally any other action-y kind of movie would be like, we need a villain and we need to explain why this is happening. But this really feels like grounded in a weird way. Like, you wouldn't just get a villain giving you exposition of why any of this is happening. You wouldn't just find a book that lays out the prophecy clearly of what's happening. You'd just be like, a lot of energy in this building. I guess that's bad? Let's go to the building full of energy?
Bad building?
Building bad? Shoot it with guns? Cross streams?
There we go.
And, like, they didn't have, like, a prophecy to tell them how to fix it or any idea what was going on. And it kind of felt really real in a very eccentric tale.
It felt very much like, even though there's a lot of story in this of, like, these guys, you know, getting fired and reaching rock bottom and starting a new business and becoming successful, it's kind of surprising how much of a journey they managed to cram in that these guys go on in the course of this movie, of a relatively short movie as well. But it feels almost very, like, villain of the week. Like, it feels very, like, almost inconsequential in these guys' lives as if they've been doing it for decades. Like, it is very, this feels like Supernatural Season 9, like, where it's just like, what's going on? It's Zool. Let's just go to the fucking funky building and shut down the funky building because they got some,
we can't,
I don't know,
die.
There's a gargoyle or something. Let's stop Zool this week.
We're the main characters. We'll 14 more seasons to go. Let's fucking throw some salt on it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very villain of the week TV structure for a movie. But I think that really lends itself well to a comedy. It makes it kind of like just fast-paced and fun and, like, don't worry about it too much.
Yeah, it's very laid back. You don't worry about the plot. You're like, oh, it's about the comedy.
Yeah.
But the comedy also is, like, not hitting all that hard for me a lot of the movie, and I wish it was more. Some scenes are so brilliant, and some scenes are just nothing to me. I can't really even think of the nothing scenes because I got a little bored and zoned out. For big scenes, I gotta say, the Bill Murray, it's true, that man is dickless, is one of the greatest deliveries slash surprise jokes in history.
Him slamming that EPA guy is so fucking good. A man who only has one scene with Bill Murray. And then by the second scene, they are arch nemesis. And Bill Murray is just playing just three-dimensional chess with this man's emotions and obliterating him in a room full of people.
I haven't seen Ghostbusters 2. We're going to do it on the Patreon. Uh-huh. I really hope this guy comes back and tries to shoot Bill Murray with a gun for ruining his life. Nothing related to ghosts in Ghostbusters 2. It's just a tale of these two men at odds with each other. Because I got to say, Villain Was Right did the EPA guy for like very, very early on. And like he's half right and half wrong. Like, let him look at your system.
Yeah. You're right, shut it down. They should not have a nuclear reactor in a residential neighborhood in New York, but have it safely removed.
You gotta inspect it first. I think a big part of your job is inspecting.
Yeah.
Not shutting down instantly without regard. It's like going to a dam and being like, shut the dam down, and then everything's gonna flood or something. I don't know what happens if you shut a dam down. But or like no one's got power. It's there's big consequences. So the you have a right to inspect, but when someone tells you a bomb is going to go off if you turn this off and you don't know what it is,
maybe don't turn it off.
And it's currently not blowing up?
Get some consultants in.
Yeah.
Get some kind of a consultant in.
Yeah.
But also that was, that character is played by William Atherton, who plays for like 10 years, just plays this type of dickhead in a series of movies. He's also the journalist from Die Hard, who everyone I don't know about all, but at least in one and two, who
the most hated
is
man.
And is just a journalist who's like, if this building's going to blow up, maybe we should tell the public and have them evacuate as opposed to playing along in order to let one rogue cop do a wild card play. And everyone's like, you dick, what are you, some kind of a reporter? But it was the 80s where any kind of oversight or accountability was a terrible thing. Thank God we've escaped that and now really appreciate the environment and journalist.
Maybe we could use a few more guys who shut you down if you pollute too much.
Yeah, like we've gotten a little bit better in their portrayal of the media, but the 80s was really harsh to be like, if anyone who works for any kind of oversight at all tells you what to do, you know better because you're trying to make some money here. And if you're trying to make money, fuck anyone who shows up and tells you how to do anything or why you should do anything. But William Atherton just kind of had that career for a while.
Yeah, that's a hard career to have. Just because, like, I think people would really hate you in real life. That many characters where you play that deeply reviled.
Yeah, that's kind of like I would say he might be like
Joffrey.
I was just about to say an 80s Cersei, but a Lannister.
Yeah.
All right. The other thing that I want to just touch upon that I think that this movie, I'm not sure if they do a good job of doing it subtly or a poor job of doing it obviously, is that with Venkman's character, with Bill Murray's character, he is the psychologist and parapsychologist. So he's in the what would be referred to often as soft sciences. Whereas the other three are hard scientists, where it's whatever it is that they're studying, whether it's physics, chemistry, or whatever it is that they might be doing. So I think he feels inadequate and is often like the joke of the scientists, which is why he's the goofy one who's trying to kind of like play off of his inadequacies and why he doesn't take his job quite as seriously, which is oftentimes in the sciences how psychology has been treated in the past, especially in the 80s when psychology would be like just wildly disrespected in the public eye. So I think that there's something interesting there that isn't necessarily fully explored. And even in the moment when Egon in the police precinct is kind of like going through like what the materials the roof are made out of, and Bill Murray's character, Venkman, has to be like, stop and explain this to me as if I do not understand metallurgy. And like he's the idiot of the group that they all have to talk down to because he's in the soft psychological sciences. So I think that there's something there as to why he behaves the way he does that isn't fully explored, or it's explored perfectly and done subtly, or it's maybe like a product of its time that doesn't necessarily hold up as well.
Yeah, it is. It is an interesting dynamic because he's also the like most aggressive in the group. He's clearly the leader, like he's the alpha male of the group, but he is the one who doesn't understand what's happening and doesn't know how to capture ghosts or how the guns work, but he's clearly the leader at the same time.
Yeah.
Which is a very strange dynamic.
I think he's the one that they all need. He's the only street smart one, and he's still educated, but yes. He's not as traditionally book smart as the rest of them, but and he is the only functional adult who could like talk to he's the only one who could talk to a city worker who came in.
He could talk to a city worker. I also feel like he's the one who can ground the scientist-y guys, because like the scientist-y guys feel like they would get very caught up in themselves of like, oh my god, well if electromagnetic electricity is going to go into the polars, then the polars are going to go opposite, and he has to be like, no guys, we got to kill the ghost.
How are we going to kill the ghost?
How are we going to kill? Stop looping around.
Stop it. How are we going to kill the ghost?
Kill the ghost. I think he's like the focus point because he can get into the psychology of the guys who are freaking out and doing too much science and overthinking.
Interesting.
So, but I agree with what you're saying. It's very interesting and hard, but entertaining dynamic of him being like, I have nothing to contribute, so I have to be the loudest and meanest, but still charming somehow.
Yeah.
Very impossible character.
And I think that there is, it's kind of hard to even conceptualize on rewatch how much of a shift in public perception there has been over the past several decades towards psychology, and especially in the media. I would say like pre-2000, the perception of psychology in, you know, day-to-day society and portrayal in the media was like, a psych is a quack, a waste of time, an idiot, an asshole. Like pretty much every psychologist in most portrayals of media in 90s and prior would be like, and it would have used like a lot of like, what is he gonna do? Just sit there and listen to me talk? Like, screw this guy. A lot of hate towards psychiatrists and psychologists. Oddly enough, as hyper-masculine as the show was, Sopranos was the show that actually was a large paradigm shift for masculinity and psychology, to see Tony Soprano actually, as much as there would be animosity in those scenes, but treat a psychologist as a professional doctorate who deserves respect. I would actually say that was a large psychological shift for hyper-masculine men to treat psychology with respect, and might have created a landslide moment for portrayal in media of how men treat psychologists. But when this movie came out, it would be a lot of negativity talk towards someone telling you they were talking to a psychologist.
That I can totally understand that. Yeah, like we're past that point, so it is hard to put yourself there. But because even in this movie, most of what Bill Murray does is just ask people if they have a history of mental illness or if they're taking drugs.
Yeah.
And they're like, that's the respectable way to do psychiatry. Be like, oh, are you mentally ill? Well, get out of here. Or you're taking drugs and that's why you're hallucinating. I will wonder, that's a great point about Sopranos.
It's often fucked me up. That's such a like such a violent,
masculine show.
And granted, it has something to say about that toxicity, similar to like a show like Mad Men, where
it's destructive.
It's destructive, but it's portraying that. But it has made such a shift in society.
Because the only other media psychiatrist I can think of is Frasier, but he is comedically doing therapy in 30 seconds on the radio.
Yeah, he
is. I'm not doing like psychosis. Like, I'm not analyzing you for hours. You're not paying me. It's free.
Yeah.
Psychiatry is a free thing you hear on the radio for 30 seconds.
And even when he's not doing it as an entertainer, even he looks down on what he's doing as an entertainer.
He doesn't see clients.
It is meant to be this like stuffy upper crust. It is intellectualizing when you have nothing better to do. It's something that blue collar people disrespect, which is how Frasier in the relationship with his father Eddie is portrayed in that show. And Pre-Sopranos is how psychology is portrayed in general. It is something that if you are a blue collar worker, you disrespect. It's a waste of time to talk about your feelings, and it is something that rich idiots do. So it's so weird. Sopranos is a weird show for what it has done. But anyway,
that's
Venkman in this movie is it's hard to conceptualize today, but I think there is subtlety to his character as to how psychologists at the time were treated and the inadequacies that they felt.
Wow. Shout out to psychologists. We respect you.
Yeah.
We think you do great work.
Yeah. Real ass science.
Real ass science. I have one of my final points, and it is a small one, and it's a thing that bothers me. I believe firmly in my soul that J. Edgar Hoover should have been attacking New York. And I don't know why it's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. I don't know how fast Dan Aykroyd thought about the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, I guess. But for all intents and purposes, it seems like if Bill Murray says, if we think about J. Edgar Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover is going to attack the New York.
To say that, you have to think of that.
You had to have thought about J. Edgar Hoover. The words don't just appear in your mouth. So J. Edgar Hoover should be blowing us up.
That said, I agree with you. As he's saying that sentence, Dan Aykroyd's face has already gone from I'm thinking deeply to oh no.
Oh, does it? I wasn't looking at his face.
His
okay.
face has
you think
already
he beat him
shifted.
To it?
Yeah, his face has already shifted to be like, what's the softest thing I know? Stay Puft. And then as Bill Murray is saying that line, Dan Aykroyd has already fucked up.
Well, I want the version with J. Edgar Hoover. I won't fight you hard on it because also I think the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man looks incredible.
All the visual effects of this movie are impeccable, especially for the time.
For the time. Like the gargoyles like running are a little bit like rotoscoped,
yeah.
But the Marshmallow Man is flawless.
Yeah.
Like this is like Power Rangers going through cities, but way better. Like he looks real. I mean, it was a real suit, but like he looks like anamorphically moving real. Like his face actually animates and moves and he gets a little angry, but he's also got that wonderful little smile, which is such a creepy way to get destroyed.
Yeah.
But he's so cute with his little hat.
Yeah. Very expressive.
Yeah. And when he's just lit on fire, like it is the perfect comedic choice of who is attacking the city. A giant marshmallow who is smiling and when you light him on fire, just is still alive and now just a moving fire pit.
Yeah, a moving fire marshmallow, mm-hmm. If you've ever touched a marshmallow,
the hottest thing in the world.
And also it sticks to you. It's miserable. It is Death Town.
It actually would be a crazy hard villain to fight.
Yes.
Like you touch him, you get covered in hot marshmallow.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Awful. It's lava.
It is kind of lava. Yeah.
If you've touched it, you know.
Yeah. It's sugar fire is bad.
Sugar fire is bad. So very impressed with how the Marshmallow Man looks.
Mm. I would say the last point that I have about this movie that I really enjoy the kind of looseness of this about the movie is that this movie, and I say this in a kind way, feels like it is the first pass of the script and wasn't second thought of in any regard. Like didn't have a second draft. It was just like the first go of it. Because a lot of this movie has loose ends in a fun way. Where it honestly feels like it was written by someone playing a D&D campaign, where they had choices to make, and there are moments in this story where I actually kind of want to know what the alternate choice was. So there are moments where, like, when Venkman is above the unconscious Dana, and he's like, I gave her some milligrams of whatever, she's unconscious, and then he's like, okay, I'll come back and join you at the precinct. It feels like that is a DM telling someone who controls the character of Venkman, do you stay with Dana or do you go join up with the rest of your party at the police precinct? And he chooses to join up with the rest of the party, but there is just an alternative path for that story to take. Much in the same way when Zool asks Ray, are you a god? It almost feels like there is a pause at a table and a DM had to be like, so what do you reply to that? And, like, the character who played Ray to be like, I'm not a god. And then the story just propelled forward. So there's these, like, open-ended questions that happen in the story that feels very, like, loose and D&D and one pass, but in a fun way.
I think I can get behind that because another scene that pops out to me as you describe that is when Bill Murray calls and he's like, oh, you have the gatekeeper. You have the keymaster. I have the gatekeeper. Let's get them together. And then Ramus is like, no, I don't think we should do that. But like, not in a way that's like he didn't yes and me, but in a way that like characters are discussing the choices they need to make. Like, oh, do we put these two together or do we keep them apart? Like, what are the goals of the campaign?
Because Egon didn't have an exact plot specific reason why they couldn't. He was like, I think maybe if they get together, they could maybe. But it was just theorizing like, okay, table talk. What do we want to do here now in this campaign?
Where do we think this is going? And yeah, leaving Dana, bold choice,
yeah.
Possessed, panting like a dog, like she's having a heart attack and drugged to the gills. Another questionable choice by Bill Murray's character. But yeah, there are some very first passes. Like like, just, like, things they don't need that are entertaining enough. Like, they don't have to be fired from the university. They could just be guys who've just started this business for no particular reason. Like,
right.
Just, like, a lot of open-endedness. Like, do they ever pay off that loan for the mortgage?
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, there's...
Yeah, that is also very just, like, we're starting a campaign. We got some cash from somewhere. We'll pay it back after we get paid out for this adventure.
Well, yeah, the adventure will pay us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it does. Yeah. So, yeah, there's fun elements there. That might be, I think that might be it for Ghostbusters for me, unless you got more.
I think the only thing that I have left to get got is going to be the final question of what would you change? So we're going to go in for the close where we ask the final question of what would you change? So if you could change anything about this movie, what would it be? But before we do ask that final question, I want to give a big thank you to our friends over at Toboggan.
Toboggan. Tell me about Toboggan, Andrew.
Toboggan Canada, they make fantastic jackets. They were kind enough to send us at the network their Leo jacket, which is just a beautiful, lightweight, synthetic down jacket that is perfect for this like fall easing into winter. Last year we had like a mild winter, so I think it's probably going to be even great through that type of weather.
Mild winter is one of the harder coats, and this is a perfect coat for that. And it like looks wonderful, but also like just the right amount of warm.
It does look wonderful, and it's perfect, and it's functional. Like, it makes me feel good inside. Like, yesterday I was coming back from the dentist. The temperature has dropped here in Toronto. I'm coming back from the dentist. It's a little rainy, kind of like misty. The temperature's taking a hard drop. It's cold. And I'm coming back from the dentist. I've had needles and drills in my mouth. I feel bad. But you know that moment where it's like, some things aren't quite right, but like your clothes make you feel good. Like it was a jacket. I was wearing it through this bad weather. I'm walking home. It's a little wet. My jaw hurts. And I'm like, I feel like I'm at home on the couch in a blanket because it's just the right thing.
Your clothes make you feel good.
It is. It's wonderful. And they have lightweight stuff, but they also have, parkas, bombers, different styles and options for different temperatures. You can get as cold as minus 30 degrees Celsius on some of their jackets. And they're all just very stylish, very cool, very well made.
Love the crest.
The crest
is fancy and nice.
The crest is very nice. The one that I have has a removable hood. I think all hoods should be removable. We don't need that 24/7. Who are we kidding ourselves?
It's removable, but it, like, it doesn't look removable.
Yeah.
You know when something's like too removable?
Yeah.
You know what I mean.
You don't want it to look like breakaway pants.
Yeah.
You don't want it to look like you're about to get subbed into the game at any given moment. Yeah, it's removable, but it doesn't look removable. And when it's removed, it hides where it was initially attached really well, which is what I like. I like their construction as well. It's just got that good quality like jacket zipper as well. Like nothing's worse than when you like get what you think is a nice jacket and then you're like, you know when you go to zip it up and you're like, oh, I have no faith in this zipper.
Bad zip feel.
Sometimes not with Toboggan. I'm incredibly happy. Fantastic jacket. Huge shout out to them. Thank you for sending us at the network your Leo jacket. I appreciate you. If you want to get your own, you can head over to toboggancanada.com. That's TOBOGGAN Canada.com. And if you use the promo code SUPERHEROES20, you will get 20% off of your purchase. So head on over to TobogganCanada.com and use the promo code SUPERHEROES20 to get 20% off your first purchase. Shout out to Toboggan Canada. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much.
And as well, before we go in for the close, we will remind you, as we do every week, if you've already done this, you can skip ahead.
Thank you, actually. Thank you so much.
You're right.
If you've already done this, you know what we're about to ask you to do.
Which is to follow, subscribe, rate, and review on whatever podcatcher you use, whether it be Apple Podcasts or whatever it might be. If you're using a browser or Facebook, we're happy that you're listening. Thank you for doing that. But hop on over to one of the apps to do it, because when you do it on the app, that counts better towards our download numbers. It helps us move up in the algorithm. It helps us get recommended to new people. And when you do something as simple and free as leaving a review, it makes it more encouraging for a new listener to actually hit download and check us out.
And also, you'll never miss an episode if you got us on an app. Mm-hmm. If you're just hoping to see the Facebook post, Facebook ain't going to show that to you.
No, you can't just be loose dogging Facebooking it out there.
You need a podcast catcher app. We see you on the Facebook and the website. And thank you so much, but you're going to be better off on that app.
Trust us. Get out of there. Stay listening to us, but get out of there. So you're going to want to do that. It's a free way to support the podcast. And while you're there, do it for, it takes a couple minutes, do it for a few of the podcasts that you love. Don't just do it for us. If you've got literally 4 minutes to carve out of your day, open up Apple Podcasts or whatever it might be and be like, what are four podcasts I frickin' love? And then make sure that you've hit follow or subscribe, leave a rating, leave a review. Couple minutes, completely free. Every podcast tells you to do this because it means a lot to all of us. Even if it's not us, do it for a couple of the podcasts you love.
You can do it right now while you're listening.
You can do it while you're listening if you're good at multitasking.
Let you, like, just open it.
It's easy.
It's fun.
And as well, if you want to support the podcast monetarily and get cool bonuses for doing it, like an episode on Ghostbusters 2, which we'll be doing later this month, you can check us out over on Patreon at patreon.com/fromsuperheroes. Patreon is a monthly subscription service where you can subscribe at whatever level you choose. You can choose $1 a month, $5, $10, $20, whatever you can afford. And there's no obligations. You can cancel or change that amount on any given month if your finances change. That's no problem at all. But if you sign up at the $10 hero level, you get a bonus episode of this podcast every single month. This month, it's not up yet, but soon we will have an episode up on Ghostbusters 2. So if you want to hear more, Bustin, if you want to hear more, Bustin makes me feel good. You can check that out over on Patreon. And when you sign up at the $10 hero level, you get immediate access to the full back catalog as well.
And if you really like us, you can even sign up for a year all at once, and then you get a month free. So think about how much you like us, and then go on head on over to patreon.com/fromsuperheroes.
Have a look. That is patreon.com/fromsuperheroes. And now, let's go in for the close. Let's ask the final question of what would you change. Diana, what would you change?
My change is mostly beginning-based, because I think once this, like, once the ghosts start happening, it picks up a little for me. I like montages, I like Zool, I like Stay Puft. So my opening changes is I'm going to bring Ernie Hudson in earlier, because this movie opens and really presumes we know who the Ghostbusters are in a weird way. Like, that song kicks in and they're like, you know who the Ghostbusters are, right? It's like, we absolutely do not know who the Ghostbusters are. So I'm going to turn Ernie into the POV character who meets the recently established Ghostbusters.
Oh, I love that.
Because he's new. He should be
The new guy.
He should be teaching us who the Ghostbusters are.
Why? Oh my God. Why isn't he the POV character?
He comes in when we already know who the Ghostbusters are.
You are shattering my world.
So they've recently been fired by the university off screen. They've just formed the Ghostbusters, but they haven't caught a ghost yet. He's going to be new from the beginning. Like, he hasn't seen any of it. So he's in new. He's meeting them. He's like introducing us to each Ghostbuster as he meets them. We meet them. And then they get like their first call for the library or whatever. And then they go, and he's kind of building on that. So his role might not even be much bigger. Like, he's not the lead, because it still will be Bill Murray, but he will be the POV, like, what do you guys do? Ghosts are real character. And I think that's more fair to Ernie Hudson, making him a full-fledged Ghostbuster, and introduces us to these characters a little bit better, and also, I think, injects a bit more peppy comedy that I'd like to see of, like, holy shit, ghosts are real, which doesn't really happen too much in this movie. Mm-hmm. People kind of calmly accept that there are ghosts through a lot of this, which is pretty ripe for comedy, I think. Sometimes it's very funny to be calm about ghosts being real, but I'd like a few people freaking out about it. So yeah, Ernie Hudson is the POV character is my biggest change.
Hot damn.
Thank you.
Hot damn.
Thank you. I know how to fix a movie up.
You've blown my mind here. It's such a, it's right there. It is ripe for the picking. I didn't put it together. Bravo to you.
Snowman, baby.
They gave you all the clues. You did it. Bravo. That is wonderful. I am 100% on board with that. My change would be it needs a better first act establishing of Don't Cross the Streams, other than a line that is just Don't Cross the Streams.
That is very haphazardly put in.
It honestly feels like, going back to what I was saying before, where the script feels like a first pass, it feels like they got to the final scene and it was like, how do we resolve this? And it's like, what if they all cross the stream and that does it? It's like, okay, but now we're going to need to insert a line earlier where someone says, don't cross the stream. And it's like, that's it. That's the line. Put that in. Everybody go home. We did it.
We did
it. There was no more artful crafting of don't cross the stream. It really does feel like it was written in at the end, and then they later inserted a single line into act one of it to establish it.
Yeah. May I pause it? Ernie Hudson, never used a proton pack before.
Could cross the stream.
Is handed his first proton pack. Yep. And is like, what if we cross the streams? And they say, don't cross the streams. Did it.
Easy. Easy. Or even, I would say, like, show some of the destruction it caused. So that one where it's at the hotel, where they destroy that banquet hall. They wreck the banquet hall by being just kind of, like, generally clumsy and inaccurate with their equipment. I think it would be more entertaining if they didn't destroy the hall until they make one big mistake with the equipment, which is crossing the streams. And maybe they only do it for like a millisecond and it wrecks that dining hall. And that is the lesson we see rather than tell of the destruction. And it's the exact same scene with the exact same consequences and the exact same ending. But now we've seen rather than been told. And we get a hint of the destruction it causes. And then at the end, they do it more intensely and longer. And they're like, if we destroyed a banquet hall with a second of this earlier, and now they're like all laying them on top of one another and really milking it. So it's building up. And then we've also got a scale to deal with there. So that's what I would like. Use the banquet hall scene to, if that's going to be the oops, we destroyed a building scene, oops, destroy a building. And make it plot relevant rather than just, oops, we were clumsy, and then we also had a one-off line.
I love that. I love the idea of just doing it for a millisecond and destroying a room, and then how, like, high my heart rate would go in the final scene of being like, four streams, no! Like,
yeah.
I saw what two streams did.
Yeah, two streams for a moment did it, and then in the end, they're.
Yeah, I love that. I would believe they blew up the entire alternate universe that Zool was in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Great change.
You great change.
I try.
Yeah.
I think your change is great. Well, aren't we both wonderful?
I think we are, actually.
Yay.
All right. Well, that is going to be it for this week on Ghostbusters. Thank you very much for listening. We are going to be back next week to talk about the Eternals.
Oh, shit. Eternals time.
It's Eternals time already.
Time for Eternals.
It's time for Eternals.
They've been waiting. They don't have a song, you guys.
God damn it.
We don't have a song for the Eternals.
If one of the Eternals doesn't tell me how they feel about Boston, I am going to be disappointed in this film already.
This is how we rank movies now.
There's a cast of 20. One of them has to mention
one
how they feel about Boston.
One of them's got a bust.
So that's going to be it for this week. We'll be back next week to talk about Eternals. And if you want to hear more Ghostbusters, we'll have Ghostbusters 2 up on the Patreon later this month. So keep an eye on patreon.com/fromsuperheroes. In the meantime, if you want to get a hold of us, you can reach me on Twitter at Ivamy, Ivimey.
You can reach me at Words of Diana.
And you can reach both of us at From Superheroes. And we'll see y'all next week.
Bye.